I think it was just a complete game on all three phases, you know. And I mean, that one wins games. You know, defense gets turnovers. Of course, we can do better in the red zone by scoring six instead of three. But I mean, you know, Connor kicked five field goals, which is amazing. And special teams got turnovers too. And then the fake punt by Brew was just big. So everybody just, you know, we came together collectively and put together a great team win.
Welcome back to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. To start off, I'll briefly run over the Wednesday practice report from the Broncos. A number of injury updates to go over there. Monte Ball, Ronnie Hillman did not practice. Jacob Tammy is a new addition to the injury report this week, as he didn't practice on Wednesday with a rib injury. Kayvon Webster still out with that shoulder injury. Wes Welker had a non-injury issue that kept him out of Wednesday's practice. Quentin Carter out with a knee. Demaryius Thomas was limited with an ankle after someone stepped on his foot. Joyce Thomas limited with an ankle. CJ Anderson full. Paul Kornick full. Aqib Talib back in full participation on Wednesday. So it looks like it'll be likely that he'll be back this weekend to take on the Bills. In a little bit of around the league news, one of the biggest games of the week had to be the Green Bay win over New England, 26-21. Green Bay jumped out early at home. New England tried to play catch up, and in the fourth quarter, despite scoring a touchdown towards the beginning of the quarter, they could not pull together drives late. They missed a field goal with about 2:40 left. It was a 47-yarder, and that turned the ball over back to Green Bay with just a couple minutes to go, so their defense had to step up, stop them, give them a three and out, and give the ball back to Tom Brady. But on a third down and four, they couldn't stop Rodgers, and after converting, they took a knee for the last few plays. It was the most yards allowed this season for New England, and they now drop back to 9-3. Third downs were a major issue for New England in this game, especially defensively. Green Bay converted 10 of 17, and the Patriots themselves only got 4 of 10 to go in their favor on offense. Though Green Bay's running game wasn't clicking a whole lot in this one, they dominated time of possession because they could string together those drives, while New England kind of struggled a little bit. So that was definitely key in that game. In the big picture here, what was at stake is definitely the race for home field advantage for the leader of the AFC. Now, New England is tied with the Broncos, and they hold that tiebreaker from that head-to-head matchup earlier this season a few weeks ago. But should they drop another one, the Broncos could find themselves in position to get back on top in the AFC. Looking ahead to this week, the best weeks, I've got four picked out here for you. New England at San Diego. The Patriots are on a bit of a road trip here, going all the way across the country to take on the Chargers, who are on a winning streak of a few games. San Diego hasn't looked great a whole lot, but a win over the Ravens was definitely big for them. Now, a win for San Diego could be good for the Broncos because that would get them possibly back into the lead in the AFC, assuming that the Broncos would win against Buffalo at home. But if San Diego loses, that'll drop San Diego a bit out of that AFC West race in the division. So that matchup this week could have implications in either race for either the conference or the division. And then the AFC North, you have Cincinnati at Pittsburgh, a great in-division matchup there. The Bengals are at 8-3-1, while the Steelers are at 7-5. So if the Steelers win, that could muddle up the standings a little bit. While if the Bengals win, that could get them a little bit of a bigger lead there in the division. And then elsewhere, if you just want a good game to watch, you've got the Seahawks going on the road to Philadelphia. Great offense versus a great defense. Both those teams looking strong. And Seattle is trying to make up ground in the AFC West, only a game back from Arizona. And speaking of Arizona, they host the Kansas City Chiefs, who are a bit down after losing two in a row in their division against the Raiders in a bit of a shocking game a couple weeks ago. And then a little bit of a thumping, I would say, against the Broncos this past weekend. They need to get something kickstarted here, and on the road against a good team like the Cardinals would be a bit difficult. But as we see week to week here, every game is a challenge at home or on the road. And as we go down the line towards the final few weeks, all these games have big implications for these teams going to the wild card or in divisional races. So keep an eye on those four games this weekend. Now Andrew Mason joins me, our columnist at DenverBroncos.com, to talk about last week's win over Kansas City, which wasn't as big as it could have been.
I feel like we came together as a whole, first time all season. it looked like guys were having fun and really love playing with each other, and that's something that we needed. That's something that I see from other teams that are doing good right now, that enthusiasm that they have playing with each other. And I think last night was really the first time we really showed that as a team.
I think it was the most complete game we've played. You know, we kind of worked off each other. The D-line was getting a good pass rush, and the guys in the back were getting good coverage, and the backers were obviously flying around like they always do. So I felt like it was our most complete game.
All right, Mace, like I said a minute ago, I thought this game was a bit of a thumping. The score won't really show it. Some red zone issues made that happen, but overall, the Broncos were dominant in this game.
Yeah, you hit on the one thing that held them back, I thought, was the red zone. A couple of near touchdowns that didn't go their way, and in general, the last couple weeks in the red zone have been a bit of a struggle relative to what the team was doing before them, but certainly it was a game that, even though it was two scores between the teams for most of the game, it felt like more than that. It never really felt like the Chiefs were in it. And certainly being at Arrowhead Stadium, it didn't feel like the crowd was in it. I looked over my shoulder and I could see outside of Arrowhead Stadium when I looked down from a press box window at halftime, and I saw people leaving. And I know it was frigid, and being on the field pregame for our Broncos TV pregame show, as we were, you know about how cold it was and how uncomfortable it was, but Chiefs fans are normally pretty loyal souls, especially when their team is good. They'll hang through tough weather, and I think they sensed the way it was going. They sensed it wasn't as close as the score indicated, and really just the enthusiasm went out like air from a balloon from that point forward. They knew it wasn't a game that felt close, and certainly the Broncos really just had them in the chokehold from the first series.
Exactly, it was from the get-go that the air in the Chiefs' balloon, if we want to use that metaphor, was that it was already half deflated by the time the game started. They allowed a couple touchdowns early, and they just never got into it. I felt like once the Broncos got that fake punt, the air just went out of the stadium.
See, that took the air up, but the in addition to the offensive drives, which really established the tone of dominance, you look at the defense, and a play that I look at, and I highlighted this in the Upon Further Review, which all of y'all listening can listen to on DenverBroncos.com. It was the Chiefs' second down play on their second series when they tried to execute a screen pass, and you had DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller coming in so fast that they basically they blew it up. They forced Alex Smith to have an errant pass on a screen pass to Jamal Charles, which is usually their bread and butter play. Usually when their offense is struggling, they get the ball to Jamal Charles in space, and he makes something happen. If Alex Smith has that pass on target, if he's not under duress and the pass gets there, I think Jamal Charles busts out for a 40-yard game because, all the blockers are in place and the Chiefs had their receivers bunched to the right and they'd drawn the secondary back, and there was a lot of wide-open territory in that part of the field. But the Broncos were so dominant off the edge. They were so in control against the Chiefs' tackles, with Miller and Ware both having big nights, that the bread-and-butter play for the Chiefs, the one that they will always rely on, wasn't there. When that happened, it was kind of the same sense of foreboding that, frankly, you could look back in the Super Bowl and see when the Seahawks had the Broncos under duress and certain things that were reliable weren't working and you knew they were kind of in trouble. That's what I sensed from the Chiefs on Sunday.
And you look at that pass rush, and that really allowed the Broncos defense to make up for some losses that they had with Aqib Talib out, Nate Irving still out, Brandon Marshall coming back from a concussion. The pass rush just really set the tone, 6 sacks. And as we heard from Chris Harris and Mitch Unrein earlier, it was a really complete defensive effort. You look at those two drives that the Chiefs scored on, but other than that, they got absolutely nothing. 35 yards from Jamal Charles on the ground, 153 yards passing from Alex Smith. Overall, they had about 150 yards net, which was less than C.J. Anderson had.
I was just going to say, C.J., I remember the Raiders game, looking at the numbers and the Raiders' late drive ensured that the team would outgain C.J. Anderson, but the Chiefs never had that kind of surge. You talked about, you know, being without Talib. You know, in all fairness, that was the perfect game to be without Aqib Talib and Kayvon Webster to basically, so to be without two of your top four cornerbacks, because the Chiefs receivers, their receiving depth has been compromised both by poor play and by injuries. They had to sign Jason Avant after he was cut by Carolina, and he really doesn't have much left in the tank, it would appear at this point. And because of that, you know, what they're going to do in terms of trying to generate plays with their passing game is it's going to be stuffed with the tight end, so you're going to rely more on the safeties for coverage than the cornerback. So if you were picking a game on the all 16 in the regular season to say, okay, you're going to be without Aqib Talib and Kayvon Webster, frankly, this game was it. So a little bit of good timing, if you can call it that, on the injuries. And, you know, going forward now, Aqib Talib's back, you know, been back at practice this weekend, and it looks great. Looks like he's going to be ready. So it seems like sitting him down for the Chiefs game, letting him rest that hamstring, is going to be the proper move.
Looking at the offense, there were two key takeaways, I would say, that you had from this game. The one is the continued emergence of C.J. Anderson with 168 yards on the ground, following up last week's 167. And the other is the red zone woes. Now, C.J. Anderson was running through people, breaking a lot of tackles, and the red zone problems were that, you know, they just couldn't get anything going once they got there and had to settle for field goals.
And I think the red zone issues, even though Peyton Manning and Julius Thomas will kind of, you know, downplay Julius's role individually in the red zone offense and the struggles it has had without him, I think if they get him back for the Buffalo game this weekend, I think that's going to be transformative. You know, he's leading the league in red zone touchdown receptions with nine so far this year. 9 of his 12 are in the red zone. You know, he can make catches with guys draped all over him. He has a great catch radius. I mean, he's almost the prototypical red zone target, probably him and a guy like Rob Gronkowski and a guy like Jimmy Graham in New Orleans. You know, you take that out and the offense isn't going to be quite the same. And we can even look back at some plays in the red zone, like, you know, Peyton Manning missed on a pass to Jacob Tammy. You know, Tammy's a pretty good player, but that's the kind of play that I think Julius Thomas would have been able to make.
And when you look at the weight of this game, just in general, you know, the Chiefs at the time were just a single game back from the Broncos in the division. Broncos have had some problems going on the road. Weather was tough, and they overcame all that and got, frankly, one of their best victories, I think, of the year outside of the red zone.
Well, not just one of their best victories, but necessary. You know, the questions about the Broncos on the road going to Kansas City, I mean, they were perfectly justified when your only two road wins are against two horrible teams, you know, like the Jets and the Raiders, that are, you know, that are already eliminated from playoff consideration and have a combined record of 3 wins and 21 losses. I mean, you know, you could argue that no team with multiple road wins probably had less impressive road wins than the Broncos did at that point. So with Kansas City and then following the Buffalo game, trips to San Diego and Cincinnati looming, that's 3 road games against playoff contenders. I think to kind of settle some unease, the Broncos had to have a good performance in Kansas City, had to have a dominant performance, and getting that, I think now they have that belief, and I think certainly Broncos fans have that belief now that the team can get it done on the road, whereas I'm not sure about what that belief was going into Arrowhead.
And now the Broncos have a 2-game lead over Kansas City. Kansas City a bit demoralized, I would say, losing a couple in a row here, all within the division. I wouldn't count them out completely of coming back in the division, but it seems like the odds are weighted against them.
Weighted against them, but I wouldn't count them out for this reason. You know, San Diego is 1 game ahead of them and 1 game back of the Broncos, but has a rigorous schedule the rest of the way, starting with New England coming to Qualcomm Stadium on Sunday night. And if the Chiefs can stay within 1 game of the Chargers and they can have everything come down to week 17, then they play the Chargers at Arrowhead Stadium And because the Chiefs have already beaten San Diego at Qualcomm Stadium earlier this year, then there's the potential for the Chiefs to have a decent shot of a do or die type situation, win and move on, lose and go home, if they get to Week 17 within one game of the Chargers. And then, of course, the other element to that is the Broncos have to do their job and be out in front and win the AFC West, ensuring that two-way tiebreaker would be possible between the Chiefs and Chargers, that the Chiefs would win with a win over San Diego.
It kind of looks like the Chiefs are mostly playing for a wild card spot. Assuming, given how the Broncos have played at this point, they're undefeated in the division, it would be pretty tough to see Kansas City do that. So, but the wild card is definitely within the realm of possibility.
Certainly, and you've got a pack of teams at 7-5. Miami and Buffalo, Cleveland, Pittsburgh, Baltimore, and then Kansas City, and then San Diego's at 8-4. Just you've and a lot of those 7-5 teams play each other. So, you've got the AFC North. They've got a bunch of games against each other the rest of the way, so they're going to cannibalize each other a little bit. And then some of the teams outside the divisions play each other. You've got a big game in the playoff race between Miami and Baltimore. So a game like that's going to help determine what the Chiefs are by the end of the season. And the Chiefs have a big game this weekend in Arizona, which is suddenly slumping with two losses. And as much as the Chiefs have struggled, would it surprise me if they go down to Arizona and win? No, not with the way the Cardinals have played the last couple weeks. So certainly the Chiefs, I think they're still in decent shape. And certainly if they can go down to Arizona and get that win, I'd actually be surprised if they did not make the playoffs.
All right. Well, thank you, Mace. Now let's go to our AFC West rundown. We've got this division game recapped, but the Raiders had a bit of a tough game in St. Louis, and the Chargers got a surprise win, but a pretty shocking comeback win against the Ravens in Baltimore. So starting with the Raiders, they got shut out 52-0. So obviously not a whole lot went right for them coming off their first win of the season. But going on the road, and plus the way they've been playing this season just in general, outside of that win, there's going to be a lot of problems that we might not have seen last week. But focusing on this game, taking on St. Louis, what did you see go wrong for them overall?
Yeah, all the progress that they seemed to have made in that win against Kansas City was pretty much lost immediately. The thing that they did against Kansas City, they really improved on things that they've been struggling with early on, like the run game and then getting off the field on third down. And really that was just, they did pretty well. The defense did pretty well getting off the field on third down in this game. But obviously when the other team scores 52 points, it's obviously things did not go right. And it was actually the second worst defeat in franchise history, only behind a game, I think, in 1961, when I think the Raiders' second year, their second season. And, they gave up 21 points in the first quarter. And for a team that's averaging 14.7 points per game, basically put them out of it 15 minutes into the game. And the Rams outgained the Raiders 203 yards to 34 yards in that first quarter. And the Raiders opened the game with three straight three and outs, and Trey Mason scored two long touchdowns in that first half, and Hill accounted for three touchdowns in a 38 point first half for the Rams. And while the Rams obviously they're much better than their record shows, but they're not a 38-point first quarter team. Their strengths definitely lie in their defense, and the Raiders' defense was just totally unable to stop them. But something that you really have to consider is, we can't give the Raiders' defense too much trouble, because their offense committed five turnovers in this game. And after the game, Derek Carr said, "It wasn't us. I don't know what it was, why they lost." And to be honest, it really wasn't them. And the Raiders, despite having such an awful record. You know, they've been playing close games, and they've been staying in games. In this game, that fast start for the Rams just was something that they could not overcome. And, you know, something that they had been, the Raiders had, was a strong point, was pass protection. And, you know, the Raiders quarterbacks were sacked 6 times and just had no time to get the ball off. And 3 of those sacks came from Robert Quinn, who obviously has been fantastic this season. And the Raiders' offensive line could not stop him. And
they also couldn't get anything going for their running backs. I mean, we've seen that McFadden, Jones-Drew combo do very little for the Raiders. Latavius Murray was a huge spark for them in the first half against Kansas City, but he hadn't cleared the concussion protocol, so they didn't have him get their running game going for them in this game. Hopefully he'll be back next week, but as far as the Raiders offense, they just got little from anything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you're exactly right. It's hard to tell if Murray's going to be a consistent guy for them because, I mean, he'd only really made an impact in that one game, but, I mean, he made a huge impact there and was that spark that they needed to get that win. And, yeah, MJD and McMadden were just non-existent. You know, that rushing game could only muster up 61 rushing yards, and the longest run that they had was 13 yards, and that just really put a lot of pressure on Derek Carr. And, you know, he had to lead this offense basically single-handedly without, you know, he's had to do it a lot all season. And, I mean, against the Rams, good defense, I mean, there was just nothing. He just couldn't overcome it. And he had a pretty rough outing with 173 passing yards and 2 interceptions with a rating of just 50.2. And actually, Matt Schaub ended up going in for him in the fourth quarter and had his first completion as a Raider, but also had an interception. So it was just bad. It was just bad for the offense. And, you know, while the defense was obviously far from impressive, you know, 5 turnovers from your offense, the Rams' average starting field position was their own 40, while the Raiders started at their own 17. So that is obviously not a formula for success.
And it's kind of funny looking at the Rams' statistics from this game. They just got so many quick striking drives that, you know, that these statistics are going to be a bit skewed. They only converted 1 third down out of 8 tries, had just as many first downs as the Raiders. But, I mean, that whole second half, they just coasted. So.
No, it's actually really, yeah, the Rams were able to score 5 touchdowns and a field goal on their first 6 possessions, and their longest time, like the longest time that they had on a scoring drive was 3 minutes and 20 seconds on that. And I mean, you know, the Raiders actually had a season high for time of possession on offense, which is something they had struggled with so far, but it was just because the Rams were just so quick striking. They got it done really quick. And
Trey Mason especially, he had that 89 yard touchdown, totaled 117 yards. We saw him look pretty good against the Broncos, but I don't think people expect him to just, you know, blow out of the gates like that.
Oh yeah, definitely. He had over 100 yards in the first half, and he had 3 touchdowns in the game. I think 2 of them were in the first half, and then 1 at the end there. But yeah, he definitely exploded in this game, and the Raiders could not contain him. And Sean Hill did not have like a crazy impressive statistical game, and I mean, he played well, and he actually had his first rushing touchdown since 2008, which was kind of interesting. And he's obviously not necessarily a mobile quarterback, but you know, he got in the end zone, and Trey Mason just spearheaded this really impressive outing for the Rams. And I mean, even though the Raiders aren't excellent, I think that the Rams definitely show that they're far better than their record in this game.
Well, I guess the best thing you can take away from this game is that it's behind them. Mm-hmm. But are things looking up for them next week?
Unfortunately, no. You know, it's this. The Raiders just have such a tough schedule, you know. Unfortunately for them, they will take on the 49ers at home next week. And
plus, the 49ers are coming off a long week after playing on Thursday and Thanksgiving.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm sure the 49ers are going to be looking to bounce back after, you know, pretty devastating loss to a rival. And so it'll be another rivalry game for them. And, you know, while the 49ers haven't been as good as their past couple seasons, I mean, they're still definitely a solid team and will definitely be a challenge for the Raiders. And, you know, the 49ers rank in the top 10 in most defensive categories, including number one in interception rate and number four in yards per game and passing yards per game. So it's definitely going to be a challenge for this Raiders offense. And, of course, the 49ers offense is excellent as well with Colin Kaepernick. I'm a little nervous for the Raiders, but, you know, things just don't seem to be getting easier for them schedule-wise.
Well, we'll see if they maybe, though, it won't be this week. Maybe in a week in the future they'll get win number two, but their schedule doesn't leave a whole lot of glaring openings for that to come. Coming up, we've got David here with us to talk about the Chargers' stunning 34-33 win over Baltimore. San Diego is now a game back from the Broncos in the AFC West. And so, without further ado, here's David to talk about that game. All right, David, so the Chargers got their third win in a row after a little skid, a little streakiness going on for San Diego right now. But this was a big win going on the road and beating the Ravens. But looking at this game, it looked like they fell behind early and just had to keep battling in this one to just, you know, stay in it. And somehow they pulled it out towards the end. Going through that game, how did they stick with it?
Yeah, I mean, it was a tough game. You have to give the Chargers a lot of credit in this game. First of all, it was a lot of fun to watch. The second week in a row, the Chargers have played a really enjoyable game, kind of back and forth. There were only two punts, so a lot of offense. But the Chargers were minus two in turnovers in this game in Baltimore, and they still won the game. Put that into context, Baltimore, with a plus two turnover margin, has lost only four times in their history. Only twice at home, and not since 1998 against the Steelers. So that's pretty remarkable. On top of that, the Ravens had never lost to a West Coast team at home in the early morning time slot until this game. 0-11 were West Coast teams coming into this game. So San Diego overcame a lot of trends to pull the upset in this one. And they were behind right from the start. Ravens went right down the field for a touchdown on their first drive. Phillip Rivers' first pass was an interception. Elvis Dumervil hit his arm as he was throwing. It went right to Darryl Smith. It could have been 14-0, but they held him to a red zone field goal, and that proved to be, you know, a theme of the day. Stopping them in the red zone, holding them to a field goal, just kind of hanging on. They had a red zone turnover in the opposing red zone when DJ Fluker forced a fumble on his own teammate. He kind of hit Eddie Royal as Eddie Royal was going down and the ball popped free. So a lot of things weren't going their way, but they just stuck with it and kept scoring touchdowns when they needed to.
And plus, it looks like they didn't have much of a rushing game going, so this was pretty much all on the passing offense with Phillip Rivers there. Only five first downs from the rushing game there.
Yeah, I mean, the running game was not real strong. It picked up some key yardage here and there. Ryan Matthews had a nice touchdown run late, but Phillip Rivers, he was precise in this game. He continued to deal with what is a really good pass rush from the Ravens and, you know, get the ball out the way we've seen him do it most of the year to his receivers when they're open, just hitting them at the right times, tight windows, getting them there on time. Really impressive from Rivers in this game.
But the running game did come up big in the fourth quarter, like the entire offense did. Ryan Matthews had a 14-yard run for a score, kicking off a 21-point quarter, which ended in the ultimate comeback for the Chargers. But how did they pull that out? They were down, you know, 33-27 with only a couple minutes left. What was that final drive? How did they do it?
Yeah, it felt like they were down 10 points pretty much the whole game. They'd score a touchdown to get within three. Baltimore would score a touchdown right back. And Chargers cut the lead to three with, I don't know, 4 minutes left in the game. And Jacoby Jones returns the ensuing kickoff 72 yards. You know, that's pretty demoralizing. So it was really impressive that the Chargers were able to finally hold the Ravens to a field goal in that situation in the red zone, and suddenly they were down six. The window was open. Phillip Rivers had about 2 minutes to march down the field, and that's exactly what he did. He hit Keenan Allen for a couple important throws, Antonio Gates, and then the big play. He threw deep to Malcolm Floyd, got a pass interference call against the Ravens in the end zone. I know John Harbaugh was complaining about it after the game. certainly both guys were going at each other a little bit, but the Ravens defensive back, Anthony Levine, basically bear hugged Malcolm Floyd for the entire play until the ball got there and sort of swatted it away. The Chargers had three pass interference calls go against them on defense in the game. This seemed like it was kind of, you know, the play that went the other way for them, worked out for them, set them up at the 1 yard line, and then a quick screen to Eddie Royal for the go ahead touchdown. Even then, the game wasn't done yet. It was still sort of hanging in the balance. The Ravens hit a big throw about 25 yards to Kamara Aiken in the final seconds near the sideline to get to the San Diego 43-yard line, but he was tackled barely in bounds by Brandon Flowers. 4 seconds on the clock, Ravens were out of timeouts. Clock ran out before the Ravens could attempt what would have been about a 60-yard field goal. So really exciting to the finish, but the Chargers hung on.
And it looks like on that last drive for Baltimore, they were really hurt by, you know, their kickoff return. After returning that one for 72 yards, this one only went to Baltimore's 14. Lucky to recover a fumble there, but didn't have the field position luck that they had previously.
Yeah, I mean, the Ravens had excellent field position all game, and a lot of that had to do with squib kicks to Jacoby Jones, and the turnovers also matter there. But you're right, after the first after the long return by Jacoby Jones, the next one he sort of bobbled it coming out of the end zone and never got anything going, got stopped well inside his own 20. So that was a big play by the San Diego special teams.
Now, we've been questioning the Chargers for a little bit the past few weeks, even going back further, lost a few in a row, and then these last couple wins before this game were not impressive to say the least, squeaking a couple out against the Raiders and the Rams, though the Rams looked really good against the Raiders last this past game. What did you take away from this one against a pretty tough game?
Well, you have to be pretty happy if you're a Chargers fan. Like I said earlier, there were a lot of odds against them in this game. The -2 turnovers, going to the East Coast from San Diego, playing in a tough environment. And there were a lot of positives to take away. The offense was excellent. Phillip Rivers, we already talked about, but really each of their offensive players gave what you would expect to see from them. Keenan Allen was running a lot of nice comeback routes, out routes, dig routes, just good chunks. He had 2 great touchdowns, really good body control in the air. Those are the things we expect from him. He 11 catches, 121 yards, 2 touchdowns. Great, great game. Eddie Royal was effective on short screens. That's what they look for from him. They use him that way, and it was effective in this game. Malcolm Floyd was useful on deep balls. He caught a 59-yard pass. He drew the pass interference on the game-winning touchdown drive. He also made a terrific catch on a back shoulder throw where he was engulfed by the DB and just somehow came down with it. So that's what you expect from him. And Antonio Gates, of course, old reliable, in the middle of the field, catching important passes on third downs. He was doing that. So certainly a lot of positives on the offense. On the defensive side, Corey Legit was excellent in this game. We've talked about him a little bit on this podcast. He's a talented player, former first-round pick. He made 4 huge run stops in the backfield. Really active. Oftentimes, those stops came at key moments. Also, you know, had some good pressure on Joe Flacco. So, a good game from him. Overall, the defense wasn't excellent. I mean, like I said, only 1 punt for each team in this game. So it tells you that the Chargers weren't stopping the Ravens that much, but you have to give them credit for stopping them in the red zone. I believe they forced 4 red zone field goals, and that was the difference in the game, no doubt. So a good enough performance by the defense, and we know their defense isn't at full strength and may not be the rest of the year. One negative I would also point out would be DJ Fluker. Really had a rough game. I mentioned that he forced the fumble of Eddie Royal, but he got burned around the edge by Elvis Dumervil time and time again. One of those forced the interception at the start of the game. We've seen him struggle against good pass rushers. Von Miller's given him a hard time. That's a bit of a question mark for them, even though he's really good in the run game.
So what do they have coming forward here for them coming up? They're only a game back from the Broncos. Pretty much every game from here on out, it's almost must win to stay up there with them.
Yeah, well, part of the reason that I think we've soured a little bit on the Chargers is they had a brutal schedule to finish, and Baltimore was one of those games. They put one away with Baltimore, which is huge because now they're hosting New England this Sunday night. We know how good the Patriots are. Then they're hosting the Broncos. Obviously, that game is crucial. If they lose that game, division is as good as gone. They won't have the tiebreaker. They'll be two games back. And then they travel to San Francisco to face the 49ers, and then they travel to Arrowhead to face the Chiefs, one of the toughest road venues in the league. So it's tough to count the Chargers out. What they did last year was really impressive down the stretch. They won important games. They won in Denver on Thursday night on the road, and they snuck into the playoffs, and then they really handled Cincinnati in the first round of the playoffs. And if this team finds a way to get across that brutal schedule, we could see them being a dangerous team in the playoffs for sure.
All right. Thank you, David. The division is far from shaped up so far. Broncos do hold that one game lead, but as you said, if the Broncos win that game in a couple weeks in San Diego, division's good as set. Broncos have an undefeated division record with just one more division game against the Raiders in the last week. And none of those teams have beaten the Broncos, so clearly the schedule for them is wild card or bust unless they beat the Broncos in week 15. And now let's go towards the Broncos' upcoming game against the Bills at home this Sunday.
Well, number one, they're playing very good team defense. And, you know, I think the strength of them is up front. You know, I think they have three guys that, you know, have multiple sacks, you know, of their front four. And then, you know, the one guy that doesn't is a high motor guy we had in the Pro Bowl a couple of years ago. So, you know, like most defenses, it starts up front. And theirs is no different.
They're an excellent defense. You know, just still getting to know them. It's an unfamiliar opponent, you know, kind of like Miami. It's always a challenge, you know, trying to get to know them during the week. And, you know, I don't know if you ever really get to know them until you play them and try to kind of get to know them, you know, during the course of the game. You know, it's different when you're playing Kansas City, when you line up and you recognize all 11 guys and kind of what they're doing. And so it is a challenge when you're playing an unfamiliar opponent. But yeah, they're playing really well together, creating a lot of problems for teams on the early downs and getting teams into third and longs. And just seem to be playing really well together as a unit. And that's helping their team win some games.
You guys feel like you put things together finally?
You know, you can't just say that after one game. You know, last week wasn't our best game. We came back and had a good game. You know, we got to be more consistent and do things on a weekly basis. So we're just trying to get better and look towards Buffalo and try to put out the same performance.
All right, that was John Fox there, and he was, well, I think he was a little bit mixed up. It looked like he meant to say there were three guys on Buffalo's D-line with double-digit sacks. You have Mario Williams with 12, Marcel Darius with 10, and then Jerry Hughes at 9.5. That's practically double digits. I think we can round up that one. And the only one in single digits is Kyle Williams, a defensive tackle with 5. I think the gist of his statement is that they have a very impressive D-line, and that's spot on.
Not a weak spot on that defensive line right now. I'd say the best defensive line in football at this point. And the thing that impresses me when you watch them is none of their starting four is weak in any area. It's not like you're saying, oh, you know, this guy, you know, is, you know, this guy is a bit soft against the run, or this guy's, you know, gives up a bit in the pass rush. No, it's four complete guys. Like, even like Mario Williams, obviously, you know, he's known for the pass rush, you know, and he's got 12 sacks, but he's an outstanding run defender. I mean, he sets the edge perfectly. Virgil Green was talking Wednesday about the challenge of having to deal with him on the outside. The thing I'll say about Mario Williams, I mean, he's back to being Mario Williams. This is the guy that, you know, was a number one overall pick, was a stud in Houston. You know, I think people have kind of forgotten about his contributions down there, and I think he first got to Buffalo, you know, the team struggled and he kind of got lost in the shuffle, but he's back to being one of the best in the league as a guy off the edge. And then Darius, you know, you go back to the 2011 draft, and there were some legitimate questions over whether the Broncos should take Von Miller or Marcel Darius. They went with Miller, the probably the more spectacular of the two. But Darius now, at a position where I think it takes a little bit more time to mature, and that's a, you know, playing on the inside like he is rather than being on the edge. You know, the learning curve is steeper, but now what you're seeing is a guy who's a true, who's, pardon me, a truly elite defensive tackle. You can't block him with one guy. You've got to devote two guys to him. And all that does is it opens things up for, you know, for Kyle Williams working next to him, who's able to capitalize off the attention that Darius gets. That the two of them are why I think if when the Broncos get to Sunday, it would not surprise me if we see more of the six-tackle line with Paul Kornick as that extra tackle, or you can call him a tight end because he lines up as eligible. You know, Kornick on one side, you know, Virgil Green working on the other side, because frankly the Broncos are going to need that kind of blocking heft on the flanks, because the inside guys are going to be so preoccupied with the Bills' defensive tackles.
That's right. The Bills are number one in sacks per pass attempt, number four in interception rate, which I'm sure is in no small part to getting so much pressure on quarterbacks.
Yeah, and funny how they don't miss Jairus Byrd at all.
And as you said, there's no weakness in this defensive line, rushing or passing, and that whole defense itself is dominant. They're number two in yards per play overall, number seven in rushing yards per play, and number four in passing yards per play.
It's the very epitome of the cliche. It starts up front, you build out from there. I mean, not that they don't have talent on the backside. Nigel Bradham's having an outstanding season. They've got, you know, Stephen Gilmore has been playing well throughout the year, but you know, everything is up front, and they're so disruptive, and they force, you know, so many, you know, quarterbacks be under duress so many times. According to ProFootballFocus.com, they've got 134 quarterback hurries. So I mean, you think about that. You think like once every, you know, three or so times a quarterback's going back to pass, he's under duress against these guys. They're that good.
I think everyone's going to have to be on their P's and Q's against this defense. I mean, that's an understatement, but they're number one in third down efficiency. Teams just struggle extending those drives against the Bills, and for the Broncos, they're going to have to put those together, get the execution they need against this team.
And the key is going to be what they do on first down, and they were successful at that against Kansas City last week. You know, they came out, you know, using Paul Kornick as the sixth offensive lineman, had some success on first down. So when they got into third downs, it was third and manageable. We saw that against Miami as well. You want to be in third and four, third and five, where, you know, you can get that quick drag or that quick out pattern to get to 6 yards and move on to the next series of downs. If you're in third and nine, third and ten against Buffalo, because they're so strong up front, because they can get into the backfield so quickly, then you're going to have a lot of problems. So, you know, what the Broncos do on first down, that's going to be as crucial, maybe even more so than just looking at the third down conversion percentage, because first down is going to set up what they do on third.
And then on the other side, the Broncos defense is one of the top in their own right. And they're facing a Buffalo offense that doesn't quite balance out with that defense. They're 27th in yards per play. They haven't been getting a whole lot out of their rushing game. Passing isn't doing a whole lot either. They're kind of just middling. Middling to mediocre, it seems like.
Middling, but they have an excuse. And I think certainly, you know, you've got the growing pains of Sammy Watkins. You still have, you know, Kyle Orton has stabilized the quarterback position, but he's still in his first year there. He's still getting to know his targets. And then, you know, not having C.J. Spiller for the last several weeks has been massive. I think if they have Spiller, you're talking about them perhaps winning a game or two that they've lost over the last several weeks. I mean, he's the most dynamic element of that offense. You go back to the 2011 game that the Broncos played up in Buffalo, and they got hammered 40-14. Now, a lot of what stands out about that last Broncos-Bills game involves, I really Tim Tebow kind of being exposed by the Buffalo defense, which just played imperfectly, basically told their edge guys, just don't get out of position, almost don't move, let him come to you and contain him, and it totally flustered him and led to some giveaways. But before all the turnovers happened late, C.J. Spiller was gashing the Broncos throughout the game. I mean, he's one of their home run threats, and certainly their home run threat out of the backfield. Without him, you know, if they're going to have big explosive plays, they're going to have to come from the passing game, and they're probably going to have to come from Sammy Watkins, who, you know, has shown flashes of brilliance, but like many rookie wide receivers, you know, consistency is an issue at this point.
As we said a couple weeks ago, every game from there on out at the time was pretty much a must win. What must the Broncos do to win this game?
Well, go back to what I said about first downs on offense against the Bills defense. You don't want to be in second and long, third and long. You know, that's where C.J. Anderson can be so good, because we've seen the spectacular side of C.J. Anderson. We've seen what he can do in the open field, but he's also a bowling ball type, and he's also a guy who's small enough and compact enough to where he can burrow his way into the line when there isn't a hole and get 2 or 3 yards to maybe where it would be one yard or no gain otherwise. You know, C.J. Anderson, I could see him not having a spectacular game, but I could see him having a very impressive game relative to what the Bills give up. So if he's able to, you know, to take those no gains and get a couple and find a way to get a couple of yards, then that's going to make that's going to open some things up for the offense. And of course, they have to keep running, and because that's going to open up the passing game a bit. Because, you know, they keep running, then you're going to have some single coverage. And I think Emmanuel Sanders, and if you get Julius Thomas back, and we'll see about Demaryius Thomas, who did not practice Thursday after having his ankle stepped on in Wednesday's practice. We'll see where he is. But there could be some opportunities for the offense to exploit some single coverage, you know, if they can continue their commitment to the run. And then on defense, you want to put Kyle Orton under duress. He's going to make some plays on you. And we can go back to when he was here. Broncos fans are very familiar with his strengths and weaknesses. You know, he'll be consistent. He'll move you down the field, but he can be forced into that big mistake, and that's where you go to the front four. You go to DeMarcus Ware and Von Miller on the edges, and I think the Broncos have some potential mismatches against the Bills' tackles, and I think Ware and Miller could put Orton under a lot of pressure and force a mistake that changes the game.
And there's some added weight to this game. As I talked about earlier, the Patriots fell to Green Bay last week, putting them in a tie at 9-3 atop the AFC. Now, the Patriots do hold that tiebreaker from the win over the Broncos at home a few weeks ago, but the Patriots are now on the road at San Diego, all the way across the country. And, you know, if we're just going with ifs and buts, if the Patriots lose, the Broncos could move into that home field advantage spot looking towards the postseason if they win.
Of course, at the same time, that would allow San Diego to keep pace with Denver if it wins. So it's, you know, the Patriots-Chargers game for the Broncos is, in the moment, a little bit of a no-win scenario. Now, if the Broncos can win against Buffalo and then win at San Diego, obviously, then they would get a lot more out of a Chargers win than a Patriots win. But, you know, we'll see. I mean, San Diego, you mentioned their win over Baltimore, and the fact they drove down the field late. San Diego's looking awfully, awfully tough. So,
yeah, it's an interesting thing to think about for us, you know, watching from the stands from afar. But for the players, it's something they'll just have to focus on this game at hand.
Yeah, there's Buffalo, as you know, we talked about their defensive line. Buffalo, there's more than enough there to concern the Broncos. And the other thing to remember, this is probably Buffalo's biggest game in nearly 15 years. You've got to go back to the Music City Miracle playoff game of January 2000 for a game that had this much weight for Buffalo. And really, I mean, you know, they're excited. They have a lot of positive momentum right now. You know, really, you know, put the hammer down on the Browns in their return to Ralph Wilson Stadium after being snowed out of the previous game. You know, they believe me, you're going to get playoff-like intensity from the Bills because you know, of what this means to them, and they know with a demanding a quarter of the season to close the schedule that they're going to have to steal a win that maybe people don't expect, and so you know they need this one, and you know they'll have ample motivation, no doubt.
I can't believe that was 15 years ago.
I can't either. That was my first year covering the NFL was a 1999-2000 season, and I covered a playoff game the following week. I was back in the ESPN.com, NFL.com office watching that, and I remember the debate over whether Frank Wycheck's lateral was indeed a lateral or it went forward. I have someone who said who was there who was pretty close to the yard line who insists it was a legitimate lateral, but I think everyone in Buffalo will tell you that it wasn't and it shouldn't have come back. It should have come back.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining, Andrew, and thank you everyone else who's joining by listening, whether that's on the site or on iTunes, where you can subscribe. Please subscribe.
They're listening worldwide. You can, you know, anywhere on the planet, you can join us.
You can get updates, so it automatically downloads to your phone or wherever, your computer. But anyway, with that, we'll leave you with our quotes of the week as we hear from players who are discussing last week's win, trying to be even keeled, and looking forward to this game upcoming Sunday in Denver.
Every game kind of takes on an identity. I mean, we still got to find a way to score more touchdowns in the red zone. Against Miami, we did that. You know, we ended up ran the ball well, but we threw four touchdowns, which, you know, we needed to help win that game. And against Kansas City, we had to settle for field goals, which, you know, could have cost us. You know, Connor was awesome making his field goals, but you still got to do your part, you know, to get your team in the end zone. We had some chance in the red zone and didn't capitalize. Every red zone opportunity has its own story. Nobody really wants to hear it. They just want to see whether you got a touchdown or a field goal. So I can't say that. I think, you know, somehow we got to find a way. I got to find a way to help us get into the end zone, you know, with Julius or, you know, all without him.
It's funny, but I lost the ball in the lights, and I'm like, is it close enough for me to catch it? And when it fell in my hands, I actually panicked. And I turned around, and it was like a 360, and I'm like, okay, where is everybody? And I seen, like, the sideline, and then I looked, and I seen, like, the red jersey, so I'm like, oh, I know I need to go this way, because all of them were right there in front of me, so I just took off running. And so, that was a big play, big back down with Terrence Knighton, and I finally figured out which way I was going, which was the right way.
I thought we had a good performance. I thought it started with a good week of practice, you know, and the urgency that we want to play with, yeah, that's something that I am going to demand every day that I'm in this position. You know, it's something I believe in. There's a mentality you have to play with. You're playing together. You need to do it urgently. You need to do it together. You need to know where everybody's going to be and play fast. And when you start doing that, then you build some of that momentum and some of that feel. And I saw it for the most part throughout the game last week, and that was good. And that just means that this week we've got to, you know, go back and start over with the preparation and get yourself geared up, you know, mentally, physically, emotionally to do it again. And that's the challenge each week, you know, for everybody that plays in this league.
You know, they really have a really good defense. They've been, I think their front four, they're in the top 10 in sacks down the line. So, I mean, they have a great front four. Their linebackers are obviously really good, and they have a good defensive back. So definitely going to be a test for our offense. But, you know, for our defense, we can only go out there and do what we do. We can't really worry about what they do. We just have to go out there and try to stop the run and get after the passer.
I mean, we play some pretty good teams, but I think across the board, all four guys are legitimate Pro Bowl caliber players. So up front is going to be a big test for us, but I believe we're ready for it, and we're willing to do whatever it takes to win.
Kyle's playing well, doing a good job in their offense, running it, leading it. He can throw the football. He's protected it. He's thrown, I think, 13 touches in four or five picks on the year, so he's doing a good job with that ratio. He can make all the throws, so we have a veteran guy that knows where he's going with the ball, and they have a good group of receivers, so we've got to make sure that we're on point.